Hey, it's us. The mic's on. Note to engineer, turn my mic on first and then the guest engineer, the guest microphone. So why don't we just start the show, Zach? Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, our live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's our Pets and Vets show this afternoon. Here to take your calls, it's Dr. Ron Scharf from the Animal Hospital of Niskayuna. You've already heard from Ron. He is a 1985 graduate of the Veterinary College of Cornell, has an extensive background in conventional veterinary medicine. Ron, nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much, Ray. It's great to be back, and I always get a great welcome. Thank you.
It's very nice to have you here. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. Be sure to get in line early. These lines tend to fill up rather quickly. You can also check in at the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. On Facebook at facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You could tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop or email voxpop at WAMC.org. Provide as much info as you can on your pet, including their age and sex, if submitting a question online. All right, Ron, let's start with one. We got an early bird on Facebook before the show started here. Here we go. Robert on Facebook asks, oh boy, our 9-year-old Labradoodle has had poop surrounded by a slimy membrane for 2 days with cramping. Now it's just very, very loose. We have not caught him eating anything strange during his 4 walks a day. There's been no change in his diet. 2 days ago, just before this started, we found a dead and gorged tick in his bed that morning. Could there be any connection to the tick and the very detailed intestinal problems, Dr. Scharf?
Yike.
Yep. Welcome back.
No, that's okay. I'm on top of this. That's all right.
Okay.
I think that there is no connection.
Okay.
I think that the slimy membrane is otherwise known as mucus.
Ah.
And whenever a veterinarian hears that a patient has diarrhea, and that's one of the more common complaints that we get presented with, the first thing that you want to try to do is localize it to whether or not it's coming from the small intestine or the large.
Mm-hmm.
If it's coming from the large intestine, otherwise known as the colon, the two hallmark signs of that would be mucus,
mm-hmm,
and blood that's more of a fresh red color than if it were coming from the small intestine, in which case that potential bleeding is more of a dark reddish black tarry look to it. So this slimy membrane tells me that we might be dealing with a colitis, a large intestine problem, not unusual in a dog, and most of them, I'd say a good majority of colitises in dogs respond to a fairly simple approach, and that is to lower the fat content and raise the fiber content of the food.
Okay.
And occasionally we use an antibiotic, a locally acting antibiotic. So, yeah, it could be from eating something strange, though there is no history of that in this Labradoodle's case. There's been no change in diet, but sometimes they can get these colitises, Ray, from just stress. It's almost like a person getting,
yeah,
a stress-induced colitis. And sometimes when you get these dogs boarding, we board dogs, and to say it's the summertime, it's July, it's hot, the dog's in for maybe a week or 10 days,
yeah,
and fourth day, fifth day rolls around, and they come down with a potentially mucoid bloody diarrhea,
oh,
and we deal with it appropriately, and they usually almost always get over it without a problem.
Well, so, now, what about the tick? Should we be watching out for Lyme disease in this case?
Well, we should be watching out for Lyme disease. However, I consider that the capital region is an endemic area for Lyme disease.
Okay.
In other words, we find positives, dogs testing positive for Lyme exposure all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And the perspective that I try to give my clients is that 95% of dogs that get exposed to Lyme will not develop symptoms.
Okay.
So it's not necessarily something to freak out about, though it can cause major problems, don't get me wrong. But I personally, my philosophy is I do not treat with antibiotics just based on a positive Lyme test. If there are no symptoms,
mm-hmm,
or if a follow-up test that I do that quantifies the Lyme is real high number, then yeah, I'll, for the high number, put them on medication. And sometimes I do hear that, you know, I thought he was normal, doc, but I thought he was just getting older, and
yeah,
now they're peppier. But if there are no symptoms or if that follow-up quantification number is low, I personally do not treat for it.
Okay, let's go to the phones. It's Bill and Troy. Bill, you're on Vox Pop.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Dr. Scharf, I have a field spaniel puppy who's 8.5 months old, and she chews everything. We've gone through numerous toys. We find that nylon bones work pretty well, but the problem we're having is that we can't find any product to put in her crate that she doesn't chew up. We've tried just about everything that we've been able to locate. I'm assuming that the chewing problem will go away as she gets older and gets away from teething. Could you give me some advice?
Good idea.
Absolutely, Bill. First of all, at 8.5 months of age, she is away from teething, Bill. All her teeth are in. They've been in for the last 2 or 3 months, so we can't blame it on teething anymore. Maybe she developed a bad habit when she was in her teething stage, which is 4 months, 5 months of age, when all those adult teeth are jockeying to get into the position there and to erupt. The nylon bones, personally, I'm not crazy about these Nylabones, N-Y-L-A bones, because they're so hard that I've seen some dogs with strong jaws go at them with such gusto that they fracture teeth.
Yikes.
And there'll be a slab fracture on the biggest tooth in the mouth, what we call the carnassial tooth, the upper fourth premolar. I'll frequently find missing its outer facing, and I assume it's because of things like that. Now, rawhide is good, although, you know, in the crate, she might decimate the rawhide and eat it up, and that might not necessarily...
What did you say? What is good?
Well, rawhide is good, but...
Rawhide, okay.
That might not necessarily stand up to your spaniels. Enthusiasm for chewing. What I would suggest, Bill, is that you go to the Kongs, K-O-N-G.
And we purchased a Kong mat, which we used last night. And I would say an hour into the night, she woke us up, and she has destroyed it.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean she's a very willful dog.
So I would use, rather than the mat, Bill, I would use some of these Kongs are made specifically for these animals that have these huge jaws, your pit bulls, your Rottweilers, animals that are totally adept at decimating most other kinds of rubber. They'll make these really harder rubber, more resilient, more invulnerable rubber. So look into one of those chew toys from the Kong Company rather than the mat. You may not want to use a mat, Bill, because I don't know that any mat's going to be able to stand up because it's providing the dog with an edge, you know, like a little corner or edge to start working on. You want something more of a round shape that she can't necessarily chew on like that.
All right. Bill, you got that?
I think I have some things we can at least start working on, and I thank you so much
for your
advice. Thanks.
Bill,
you're
thanks
welcome.
For the call. Let's go over to Wilfred in Kingston. You're on with Dr. Ron Scharf.
Yes, and thank you for taking my call. I have a Springer Spaniel who happens to enjoy Adolf Manjou movies on Netflix.
I see, Wilfred.
Now, I've run out of feature films of Adolf Manjou. Is there another actor you think my Springer Spaniel will enjoy?
Hey, you're right, kind.
I would go Wilfred with the Three Stooges, I think.
That's a good plan.
Three Stooges.
Wilfred,
well,
thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Appreciate the call. You always bring something to the table. We thank you. Let's go to Bonnie in Ashfield. Bonnie, you're on with Dr. Ron Scharf.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Hello.
Hi, Bonnie.
I have a 10.5-year-old Alaskan Malamute. She loves carrots. She's a seizure dog. She's on one grain of phenobarb twice a day, 12 hours apart. She gets no table food. She's eating one cup of Beneful Weight Control twice a day with her pill. And she's actually gaining weight. She was 65. Now she's like 74. And the vet says that she should drop some weight and I should increase her vegetables. I did increase her carrots, but she seemed to get a little case of the runs. What other vegetables could I incorporate into her food and lessen her dog food ration?
All right.
All right, Bonnie. So I wonder if the phenobarb might be an actor here, might be a player in your animal's weight gain. And so I think that as far as the vegetables are concerned, Bonnie, with one or two exceptions, almost any vegetable is fine for an animal. The exceptions are onions and garlic could be toxic if eaten in enough quantity.
Really?
Yes. And,
okay, I thought grapes weren't good either.
Well, that's
true?
In the fruit family. I was about to mention parenthetically that to a small percentage of dogs, grapes and raisins could be toxic to the kidneys, but it's not across the board like the onions are. Onions are toxic potentially to all dogs and especially cats. Especially
okay.
cats.
Wow.
And also, to a lesser degree, garlic in a high enough amount. But, yeah, they can cause major Heinz body hemolytic anemia in cats and other bad stuff. Almost any other vegetable, Bonnie, is fine. You want to use some common sense. You don't want to give too much of anything. You don't want to give things that have inedible parts to them. You know, people give apples with the apple cores. Not that good. Obviously, you wouldn't want to give peach pits or etc. You don't want to give too much bananas. Then they get bound up. So you want to use your common sense. But I would wonder, you know, she usually will have an higher appetite, but the vegetables and fruits, I don't know if you're going to be able to satisfy that whole appetite. You might want to start looking into a higher fiber food, Bonnie, so that they get your pup, she gets filled up easier because she's got a higher fiber content. And it might even be something like just adding some fiber, some pumpkin, canned pumpkin or something like that might be another strategy to look at.
All right.
How about adding rice? Would that, you know, be any, like a brown rice or something like that as opposed to a white rice?
Well, first of all, brown rice is, in general, we think of brown rice as being more healthy than white, and it is. But animals and carnivores in particular do not have the gut structure that enables them to handle that tough seed coat that the brown rice has, as much as, you know, herbivorous or omnivorous, more omnivorous animals. So, but I would not go white or brown because that's just going to be empty calories. It's just going to help her gain more weight. That wouldn't be the best way
okay.
to do it.
Bonnie,
I mean,
we got to go ahead. We got to take a break, but you can wrap it up.
Okay, I was just going to say, she doesn't look heavy or anything, but, I mean, she has put the weight on. And,
it's because she's a Malamute, you know, and she's got 2 feet of fur there.
Yes, I know she does. All right, thank you so much.
Yep, Bonnie,
okay,
thanks
Bonnie.
A lot. Ron Scharf is our guest. It's Pets and Vets. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. And thanks again to Wilfred for calling in that important movie question. More Vox Pop coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting From Giverny to the Brooklyn Bridge, American Impressionist Paintings from the Arkell Collections, arkellmuseum.org. Earth Angels Veterinary Hospital, Wappingers Falls, an integrated facility that combines conventional and holistic medicine for a 360-degree approach to veterinary care, earthangelsvet.com. The Alternative Baker, Rosendale, artisan all-butter baked goods made from scratch, handcrafted lemon velvet cakes and egg sandwiches daily. Where taste is everything, lemoncakes.com. Charles Padula, DDS, Union Avenue, Schenectady. Family dentistry, including laser cavity detection and computer-aided local anesthesia, PaduladDDS.com. And Performance Automotive, Pittsfield, a European and Saab service center serving Western Massachusetts and the greater Albany market for 25 years. Saab, it's not just a car, it's a passion. SaabPerformance.com.
And here we go. It's Vox Pop once again. Ron Scharf is our guest. He is back with us, closing in on his 100th show. Eh, Ron?
Oh, yeah. Very close.
Very soon now. It'll be a, we'll have
very
to get a
nice.
Cake, right,
the centennial,
Patrick?
Yes.
Yeah. Patrick Donge is our producer here with a couple of questions from various electronic means.
Yes.
Take
we have Darlene via email asks, I'm concerned about my children feeding one stray cat. The cat is aggressive towards other cats and is sometimes injured. My children would use peroxide to address the wounds, but this time its ears are badly injured. What should we do? We have no pets, not thinking of adopting.
Okay.
So if that question is, Darlene's asking, can her kids help heal the feral, potentially aggressive cat that might be getting into fights with other cats?
Right.
Okay. So Well, they could wear gloves. They could wear exam gloves. But the thing is that there are several things that they could catch from a cat. One of the first things that comes to mind is cat scratch fever. Cat scratch fever.
Do you have that song ready to go, Zach? No, we don't have
Bartonella,
that
Bartonellosis is something that just the scratch from a cat that has it, usually more commonly from a kitten to a younger kid, but anything's possible.
Okay.
All they want to do is wash their hands thoroughly with soap and water for a good 20, 30 seconds minimum after they handle the cat in any capacity, because anything that comes out of any animal's body, whether it's a feral cat or a domesticated pet, has the potential for carrying parasites and things that we could be
exposed to. Should she be concerned about this cat potentially biting or scratching?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I personally, you know, feeding the feral cats, I'm not exactly a fan. I mean, it kind of creates a bad neighborhood.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. Okay. And then last one here. Lawrence on Facebook asks, can guinea pigs catch human flus or viruses?
Very good. Very good.
So I'll just have to guess on this one, Patrick and Lawrence. I would say probably not, but not definitely not. Most flus are species-specific, but look at all these big news items that we've heard in the last, I don't know, 3 to 6 years about flus transmutating into from bird flu to a swine
just this
flu.
Week.
Yes. And, you know, after all, this canine influenza was discovered in 2004, and which I just personally, as a veterinarian, have decided this year to carry the vaccine for, it was not in existence before 2004. So it was one other species kind that mutated over. So it's not out of the question.
The jury's still out.
In general, no.
Okay.
In general, no.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's Patrick Donjas, our producer. Thank you, Patrick. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Duggar.
All right, and back to the phones we go. It's Barbara in South Deerfield. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hi, Barbara.
I am allergic to everything, so I'll make this quick. I will start coughing. I have a dog who's 10 years old. He's a small, kind of Doberman-y, kind of mixed kind of guy. He's just been diagnosed with calcium oxalate crystals in his urine. So we need to put him on a special diet, and we need to avoid all kinds of foods that have oxalates or calcium in them. So I'm wondering if you could tell me something about this condition and if there's any place that I can get his food more cheaply than at the vet's, because it's really quite expensive.
Okay, so Barbara, if you had asked me this 10 years ago, I would have said, it's a very simple situation. But now, you know, we're always gathering more and more information, and I'm not as certain that it's as simple as I used to think, and I'll tell you why. I used to take very seriously any time I would see crystals in an animal's urine. Nowadays, when I look at it with a more critical eye, I notice crystals in the urine of normal animals on a regular basis. And just seeing a few crystals in there in and of itself doesn't necessarily carry significance unless there are either symptoms or evidence on the rest of the urinalysis of inflammation or infection. So in other words, red blood cells, white blood cells, that kind of thing. Now,
the vet had actually said that it was a high level of crystals, but no other symptoms, no blood in the urine, no other problems.
All right. So the problem is, Barbara, that of all the crystals, there are several kinds. The calcium oxalate does have special prescription foods that are made just to address that issue. However, the calcium oxalate are more resistant to being handled by diet alone than other crystals such as magnesium ammonium phosphate, which those crystals can not only be gotten rid of with special foods, but even if they clump together and form stones, occasionally those stones could be dissolved just if the animal goes on the right food for a month or two or three, whereas the calcium oxalate, that's not the case. So as far as foods that you can get over the counter that are cheaper that would address the issue, I am not aware of any of them. But I will tell you one thing, Barbara. Far and away, whatever the crystal is, whatever the animal's problem in the urinary tract, the lower urinary tract is, canned food is better by far than dry food. You want a urine that's as dilute as possible, and that canned food's got way more moisture content in the food than the dry.
Mm.
And so no matter what food the animal's put on, I would always prefer it be canned food for this kind of problem.
Okay.
All right, Barbara. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Good luck.
Good luck, Barbara.
Let's go. Oh, by the way, the number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. One open line at the moment. Harriet in Woodstock, you're on with Dr. Ron Scharf.
Hi, Ray and Dr. Ron.
Hi, Harriet.
Hi, I've called you plenty of times before.
Well, nice to have you back.
And, well, my question is kind of diffuse. I have a 20-year-old Westie mix of some kind.
Wow.
20?
And he's 20.
Wow.
And he, at this point, really is 20. And he's got, for the most part, he's strong. His heart is strong. He's got a tough little body. But he has, actually, we're going into our own vet tomorrow. We go pretty regularly with this. He's got a huge, grotesque tumor on his lower jaw. It's really getting bigger. Sometimes it bleeds a little. It seems to be finally interfering with how he... I've changed his bowl so the rim doesn't get in his way. I'm now hand-feeding him. And he doesn't seem to be in pain, but he's... Every day he's a little different. You know, he doesn't want to be outside so much. And, of course, he has canine cognitive disorder, and he walks into walls and things. And his vision is poor and his hearing is poor, but he can see and he can hear. So I'm sort of asking, and the tumor is not operable. We've been through all that. What am I... That's a really hard decision because I have a strong little dog.
Right. Obviously.
And what am I looking for? How will I handle this? I just don't know how far to go with him and his life.
Hmm. Yeah, well, sure. That's a great question.
Harriet, is this a jaw tumor? Is this a bony tumor you're talking about?
It seems to be on it's not in the bone, or we don't think so. But now it seems to... It's on the outside of the jaw.
Okay.
It's bigger than a golf ball, and it's really hideous. And it does now seem to be, when I can look at it, because he won't let me really examine him closely. He just fights all of that, you know, examination.
Okay.
It seems to be growing on the inside as well.
Okay. So a few things I would recommend, Harriet, before I address the bigger part of your question, which is a good question and a classic question. First of all, I would feed the dog a gruel, something that did not necessarily have to be chewed, but could be more almost swallowed or drank, rather.
Slurped.
Than chewed.
Slurped.
Yes, slurped. So feed food that is easier for him, her?
Him.
Him.
Yeah.
To swallow in a digestible size, number one. Number two, anticipating the possibility that it was now, at this point, on the inside of the mouth as well, I was going to recommend that you used an antiseptic that you could put into the water. The Biotene company, for instance, suggested for owners of animals who can't or won't brush the animal's teeth but do want to do something about dental health. There was an antiseptic. It's odorless. It's tasteless. You put it in the water, and hopefully it would help diminish that bacterial population, which this tumor could be encouraging. Number three, if it gets bad enough, depending upon if there's any smell, et cetera, antibiotics might be good for the infection part, because eventually if a tumor gets big enough, there's often going to be an infection. Beyond that, it's a little hard for me, Harriet, to say in terms of specific things, steps you could take. But as far as how far to go, that's a trickier and a more challenging question, Harriet. And I look at it as a quality of life issue. Is the quality of life of your old pup better than the cost or downside that he's dealing with, or is all the problem are all the problems as a result of this tumor starting to outweigh his quality of life? So the two essential ingredients to quality of life in my mind, Harriet, are number one, Does the dog enjoy engaging with the world? Does the dog enjoy attention with from you? And number two, what is the appetite like? Now, I don't mean appetite in terms of is an oral tumor interfering with the ability to eat so much, as how much drive for life does the dog have? How much drive to eat and to partake of that? Because if you have to almost force the dog to be eating, and if the dog is impassive to attention from their owner, then I start questioning, maybe it's time for that animal to go to a better place, if you know what I mean.
Well, he does love his food, I must
Good.
Say. He does not care about the world at all.
Well, at 20 years old, I guess,
you know,
he deserves that.
Yeah.
But he's never been, I can't comfort him. You know, he's not a dog. He's never sought affection. He's always been a bit aloof, and he's also a dog that when you come in contact with him, as much as you warn him that you're there and you're coming, he still jumps out of his skin when you touch him.
Well, you have to be careful with any dog that is losing their visual acuity and the hearing, because they get enveloped in their own world, and it's usually an older dog, of course.
Yeah.
And if something jars them or touches them and they startle, it could be very it could be potentially risky for a person. That dog, depending upon their personality, easily can snap at someone because they feel threatened, because they're in their reverie, they're just in their old dog kind of place, and then they get startled, and it's scary for them because they don't have those senses like they used to. So you do have to be careful.
Yeah,
he's always done that, startled. Even when I first got him,
he's a crusty guy.
Yeah,
a lot of terriers are like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if he always was the kind of dog that was not crazy about, you know, cuddling and being sentimental, then it would be harder, be more challenging, Harry, for you to use that as a criterion as to whether or not his time has come. So if the appetite's there, I would be inclined to all other things being equal to keep going.
Okay,
Harry.
That's good.
As long as he's happy to have his dinner, I should
exactly.
Just...
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Harriet, thanks a lot
Good
for
luck,
the call.
Harriet.
Let's go to Bob in Saratoga. Bob, you're on Vox Pop with Ron Scharf.
Oh, hello. I have a question. It's not a physical problem. I'm going to be providing care for a dog and a small female dog, as the larger dog is male, a pit bull. And it seems to do a lot of barking, particularly like if I make a move, it barks a lot. But it's wagging its tail. If I come to the door, it's wagging its tail but barking. And, you know, I'm, as I say, going to be providing daycare for 2 days. And just trying to get an idea why you think the dog might act that way and what I can do to minimize it. I've tried, like, feeding a dog. I walk the dog. And he wags his tail when he's coming and barking. The only thing I can think of is the dog got traumatized when I came by one time. It was kind of an emergency. Something like a midnight or 1 a.m, somewhere around there. And I'm thinking it got off to a bad start because that was the first time I ever met the dog.
Don't take responsibility, Bob. I'm sure it was not just one person and one experience that caused the dog to bark a lot, and even at times where it's wagging its tail. Now, oftentimes, barking is not necessarily to express displeasure or aggression, but it can be a fun, playful expression also. In this case, I'm not saying that that is true, but I just wanted to make clear that barking in and of itself is not necessarily a threatening, though it can be. Now, I see, Bob, plenty of dogs that can be showing conflicting signals. In terms of that they're aggressive on one part of the body and they're submissive or happy on another part of the body. So kind of like this example here, I'll get an animal in my exam room, Bob, and they'll be growling and wagging his tail at the same time. These are confused dogs. These are dogs that were brought up with mixed signals themselves. Mm. They were given signals which somehow or another encourage them to be displaying what usually would be conflicting signals because they themselves are confused. And personally, it is very hard for me to trust any of those dogs. I have dogs, for instance, I'll give you another example, that bare their teeth. In other words, they smile. Okay? Now, in my world, dogs baring their teeth is not a good thing. Okay. However, it's true. I mean, I can vouch for some of these people that their dogs are not threatening when they bare their teeth. That's just maybe they were encouraged, Bob, they had positive reinforcement when they were 2 months of age, so to bare their teeth, for all I know. Maybe they got a treat. Maybe they got some cuddling when they did that. So they took that to be something that would get them something tasty or fun in their world. But in your case, Bob, this is not your dog, so it would be hard for you to work with this dog to try to unobfuscate its world. In other words, teach them clear signals of what is acceptable behavior and what is not acceptable behavior, so that when the dog is acting calmly and not barking is when it would get its attention, when it would get its treats, when it would get its playtime. But whenever it's barking, I would not give it any attention, would not give it any, I would not look at it, I would not engage with it, I wouldn't play with it or feed it. I would just be very, very unavailing, so to speak, whenever that dog barks. Teach that dog that it's going to get nothing good from you whenever it's barking.
Bob, we got to take a break. Zach, let's take a break right now and back to the home stretch with Dr. Ron Scharf. Boy, it's moving fast. One open line at the moment, 1-800-348-2551. We'll try to get you in. More with Dr. Ron Scharf coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Bow Wow Bathhouse Resort and Daycare, South Deerfield, Massachusetts. For over 7 years, providing 10 hours of daily indoor-outdoor play, professional grooming, and retail shop, the BowWowBathhouse.com. Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment, Berkshire.coop. Ashokan Center, Olive Bridge, New York, a classroom in the wild helping schools, organizations, and individuals reconnect with nature, history, and the arts, AshokanCenter.org. And the Albany Academy and Albany Academy for Girls, single-gender education for boys and girls for nearly 200 years, informational lunch session tomorrow, noon through 1:30 p.m., AlbanyAcademies.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC, and Dr. Ron Scharf is our guest back here for, it was 97th, 98th show, something like that. Welcome back. And also in our studio is our producer, Patrick Donges. Patrick, what's the latest from the social media?
Hello, Raymond. Hello. Michelle on Facebook asks, our budgie has learned to say, Max is a pretty bird. Can budgies learn multiple human phrases, or will he just confuse him by trying for something else? Like, bird is the word.
Bird is the... Now, wait, you really don't do... it's not your strong point, right? The birds thing?
No, but I can answer this question.
Okay, go ahead.
The answer is yes. You could teach your budgie, which is otherwise known as a parakeet, to say more than one phrase.
Okay.
You just have to give them that phrase often enough and provide positive reinforcement. But it's not like they have a limit of one phrase per bird per life. It doesn't work like that.
You know, we should get a budgie for the newsroom. We'll put him down by my end, and I'm sure he would come up with some very interesting phrases.
Some choice phrases.
Yes.
Sweet.
Depending on the day.
Put that on the meeting.
All right. I've heard some good stories along those lines.
We'll set a meeting.
Patrick Donges is our producer. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Ray.
Back to the phones we go. It's Ann and Medusa. Ann, you're on.
Hello there. I'm glad I got through. I have a little 8-year-old female Chihuahua Corgi mix rescue dog. She was diagnosed with Lyme disease, and I'm told that she can get it back.
Okay. So the answer is, and yes, however, I'll track a lot of these dogs that are positive for Lyme. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, Lyme is pretty much endemic in our area. It's very common to find dogs that test positive for exposure. And although the majority of them do not get sick, no one thinks that whether they get, even if they get treated for a month, which is the standard regimen, you do not. The dog never totally eliminates all of those Borrelia spirochetes from their bloodstream.
Oh.
So when I test them every year, because it's part of the heartworm test. It includes a Lyme test, so we get the opportunity of checking it out every year. I'll see that many of these dogs, Ann, will start turning negative about 4 years after their exposure. It might be 5 years. It's not always the same. But that means that even though there's some still in the system, they're not elaborating enough for the test to show them up as a positive. Now, I think that it is possible for something to come along, either some problem with the immune system or some other disease or some trauma or some other stressful thing, which might allow that low-lying population of Lyme bacteria to proliferate and cause a problem. But I suspect, Ann, and it's only a suspicion, that most recurrences are more from newer exposures than from that older population. I don't know if there's any science. I don't know if there's any studies that have been performed to answer that question. So I'm just giving you my best clinical sense, Ann.
Okay.
Well, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
She's an outdoor dog. She thinks she's like a real dog, even though she's little. One next quick question. Any ticks, deer ticks, I pick from her, she wants to eat them.
Oh, boy.
Really?
It's pretty gross.
Yeah.
Well, I would like to just say, Ann, that she thinks she's a real dog because she is a real dog.
Oh, all right. All right.
And the eating of the ticks, I don't know what to make out of that. I would imagine that it would not be a problem. However, I would not want that dog nor any person to do that because those ticks can carry diseases that we can get, that dogs can get.
Sure.
And even though those diseases are designed to happen when they are injected into the dermis or the epidermis, the possibility of being ingested would probably, you know, kill them and kind of inactivate all those diseases. But the operative word is probably. I would never want to make that assumption that eating a disease-filled tick is to be no problem. I would try to keep the dog away from those ticks.
Well, Ann, thanks for bringing that up, and good luck.
Thank you.
Bye.
You're welcome, Ann.
Okay. Brenda in Clifton Park. Brenda. Hello?
Hello?
You're on.
Hi. I have a question. I have a 9-year-old cockapoo, one of three. I have three brothers from the same litter. And one of them gets growths, like kind of like moles, but they actually, I don't know, they used to look like moles, and now they're looking more like growths, like round, I don't know, like one actually looked like an organ on the outside of him a couple days ago, but now it seems to be smaller, but he picks at them and licks them and bites at them, and they're all over his head and legs and back, and they're just all over. And but the other two don't have it. They're from, you know, they're all the same age and from the same litter. And I'm just wondering if there's anything that we can be doing to treat them or to stop them. Or
all right,
so Brenda, I don't know if it's a pox or if they are tumors, or if there's something else. I would have that bird looked at by a vet that knows birds.
So it's not a bird. Oh, I'm sorry. They're cockapoo.
Oh, cockapoo, not a cockatoo.
Oh. They're dogs.
You did throw me. You did. Right, well, okay.
Start again, okay. But let's skip part of the bits about
three
the tumors.
Three cockapoos, three brothers. One gets gross. They start like moles. Now they're gross. They're round, and he picks at them.
Yes.
Okay. Ah. Now, are they smooth?
Well, no.
Okay. So if they're not smooth and he has a lot of them, I'll go out on a limb here, Brenda, and I'll think that they are what we call sebaceous adenomas. And the reason I say that is because I see a ton of them. And a dog that gets one is a dog that can get many. They're not infectious, but they can get knocked against things, or they can be something that gets on the dog's mind, or they chew at it, and then they bleed, and then they scab over, and they're very inconvenient. So if it's a sebaceous adenoma, it's a benign tumor, It's nothing to worry about other than the inconvenience of it.
So, even if there are 100 of them or 30 of them?
Yeah, well, they can by that. Well, I never saw any with 100. But sure, if they have a lot of them.
I would say he probably has 15.
Yeah. I would only deal with the ones that are problematic, the ones that are either bleeding, scabbing over, or the ones that are bothering them. You could take those off easily. They're easy surgeries. But that's only if that's what it is. The first thing you want to do, Brenda, is get a biopsy of at least a couple of them just to confirm, am I right? Because, like I said, I'm going out on a limb to make that diagnosis. I've never seen the dog, let alone the growth. Mm. Sebaceous adenomas are very common.
Are they caused by diet or by,
no.
Like, are there vitamins?
No, they're tumors. They're benign tumors.
So if you get rid of them, in theory, they're going to come back, right?
Yeah, because whatever predisposed you to getting them in the first place is still going on.
But, he's been getting them probably for, I don't know, maybe a year, maybe 2 years.
Get a diagnosis. Just send a couple of them into the lab to see what they are. You know, histopathologically, find out what you're dealing with, and then it would be easier to make, you know, plans or decide the best way to handle it, because that would depend upon the diagnosis, Brenda.
Okay. Brenda, thanks.
Okay. Bye. All right. Well, thank you very
much. Good luck.
Much.
Get back to us. Let us know what they are.
Okay.
Thank
you. All right. Thanks.
So, if they weren't benign and it was been going on for a couple of years, you would see other symptoms by now, right?
Likely, but not definitely.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Paul in Niskayuna. Paul, you're on with Dr. Ron Scharf.
Hi, Doctor.
Hi,
quick
Paul.
Quick question. I've lost two dogs, two golden retrievers to cancer. One was 7 years old. One was 12 years and 3 months old. And they're both female. Is there some connection between golden retrievers and cancer and golden retrievers who are female and cancer? Or what? Why did they both die from cancer?
Yeah, I lost a golden to cancer also, Paul. Goldens do get more than their fair share of cancers. They get hemangiosarcomas. They get a few others, more than the general population of dogs. I would not think that the female part of it has anything to do with it unless they were mammary tumors. I think, Paul, that there's a whole heck of a lot of cancer out there. As a matter of fact, every animal but one that I've ever owned, personally, I've lost to cancer. And it does get pretty tiring and brutal after a while. But I feel badly for you. Do you know what kinds of cancers they were, Paul?
Well, one was cancer of the spleen.
That's the hemangiosarcoma that I just mentioned. And that's what I lost my golden to, because a lot of them get it. A lot of goldens get hemangiosarcoma of the spleen. It's brutal. And what was the other one?
The other one, I don't remember what the other one was. It's started vomiting, and we took her in and she said they had to put her down. I don't recall what cancer it was.
I'm sorry to hear that. Well, I think it's a pretty good guess that if it was a splenic cancer, it was something that we call hemangiosarcoma. If you catch them real early, sometimes if you take the spleen out before it's spread elsewhere, you might be in good shape, but often you're not. And sometimes it's very difficult. I always remember when I learned my internal medicine and surgery at Cornell over a quarter century ago, I might say, I'll always remember the famous fingerprint story that we got from Dr. J. Harvey, who is still practicing and is still on the faculty at Cornell, a great surgeon. And his fingerprint story was of a dog that had had that same cancer, was taken care of by their vet, and then when it recurred, it went to Cornell. They did an exploratory to see what was going on, and they saw fingerprints all over the rest of the organs. In other words, the first vet had touched the spleen and then did an exploratory with the same pair of gloves before closing. So that's how spreadable this hemangiosarcoma is.
Wow.
And you always want to change gloves, and you always want to do your exploratory before you touch a cancerous organ if possible.
Well, Paul, good luck.
How long would this cancer be in the spleen for it to rupture and cause it to bleed internally to death?
Months.
Months.
Yes.
And the only symptom we saw was that she didn't eat Wednesday night, didn't eat Thursday night, and we took her in Friday morning to get her diagnosed, and she never came home.
Yeah. Yeah, what can happen is if the bleed is not that bad, they'll recycle, they'll resorb and recycle those red blood cells that are free-floating in the abdomen, and then rally. They seem to rally. They regain their strength. They're not anemic anymore until you have the next bleed, and that could be the last one.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. We go to Kate in Richmond. Kate.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Kate.
Hi. I have an ethical question, I think you'd say.
Okay.
And it's about one of our cats, and my apologies to our sweet friend who gave us that cat as a kitten.
Uh-oh.
So one of them is Scarlet, and she's a sweetheart. She's docile and gentle, and she has a sweet tiny meow, and she's happy to be held by my six-year-old. And then there's Periwinkle.
A great name.
You'd think we'd come up with a great cat, but she's just antisocial, and she's really irritating. She has a really loud kind of yowl when she's hungry, and the worst part, I guess, is that she is a horrible food thief. So when I turn my back for 1 second, like to get the kids on the bus or something, she's up on the counter chomping away, and she can steal a pancake in a nanosecond.
So, oh, interesting.
It's just a pain. You just can't leave anything. And I think one of our biggest jokes is when we walk in the front door, she looks at us like, "Who are you people?"
Yeah.
And she runs away. And so she's just not a sociable cat. And the dilemma is, we feel guilty just if we took her to the Humane Society, since we've had her since she was a kitten.
Right.
But we'd also feel guilty because the next person that might think she was a lovely cat would find out that she's not. I don't know.
Maybe she'll be lovely with the next people.
I think maybe you should think about giving that cat to Ray. I think Ray likes cats.
Yeah.
If I didn't have a house full of a very allergic family, I would take that. I love kitty cat. What kind of cat?
I think the person we got her from thought that one of the parents was feral.
Ah.
So she's just, I don't know what you call, like a black and white. She's just,
so, Kate.
Yeah.
I'm gonna a little take a chance here that I won't get skewered by my answer.
Oh boy.
Because you count, and your family counts, and I find a lot of people, I don't know if it's a guilt complex or what, but they will allow their lives to be turned upside down at the whim of a pet that may be going on and on chronically for years, and eventually I tell people, you know, it's your house, it's your home, it's your family, and that counts in your decision-making. Mm-hmm. It's not only what's good for the animal, it's also what's good for the people. And
right.
So I think, depending upon how bad it is, you don't necessarily have to take that cat, Kate, to a shelter, to a kill shelter.
Right.
You could take that cat to a no-kill shelter. You could take that cat, you could take ads out. You could go to your vet and have them put it on their Facebook page,
put
a nice picture in the exam room, in the waiting room. You know, come over to my place, my vet hospital, give us a nice picture. You always want a good picture
because
words don't sell animals. And some of the best luck we've had at rehoming animals is actually putting the animal in a crate in the waiting room. That's even better than
wow.
a picture. But I think that if you need to decide, Kate, how important is it for you to not be living with that, which I agree with Ray, that's a great name, Periwinkle. how important is it? Because if you decide that it's that important enough, then listen, don't feel bad. Don't feel guilty.
Right.
Just go for the best home you could find for that cat, and you don't have to worry about it the rest of your life.
You know, in the past, you've talked about inter-pet dynamics. Is this just a case where Periwinkle is not all that pleased with the other kitty cat in the house?
It's very possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's very possible that I find all the time. As a matter of fact, just yesterday, a woman, a client that had two older dogs, and one of them got a bad problem, a cancer, and finally had to be euthanized. And I was consoling her. And then she said that the other dog feels like $1 million. Ah. The other dog has the whole place to itself, and he's doing great. This is Buddy. I hope I'm not disclosing too much private information. Nice. But, yeah,
can
sometimes that happens. The whole dynamic can change.
Well, I got to tell you, that's the end of the program. Kate, thank you for calling. And Dr. Ron Scharf, nice to have you back. We have touched many bases today. It's always good to have you here. We'll see you soon. Support comes from Rhinebeck Equine Hospital, providing a team of equine specialists in medicine and surgery, open 24 hours, 365 days a year for emergency services. RhinebeckEquine.com. Carrie Haddad Gallery, presenting Color Theory, paintings by Paul Schuschman and Urban, featuring works by 7 photographers through May 26th. CarrieHaddadGallery.com. Kingsway Community, Schenectady, New York, announcing open house on May 2nd from 1 to 5 p.m., offering a continuum of care and services for seniors, caring in the family tradition, 518-393-8800. And Lori Stillwell, CPA, PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond, stillwellcpa.com. Thanks to everybody who called in today. Sorry if you did not make it through. Thanks to Zach, the engineer. Fine job there, Mr. Zach. Our calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell, producer Patrick Donges. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's The Gardening Show. Look out for that one. Stay tuned now for a news update.